Artificial intelligence has never been portrayed well in movies. Think of the Terminator flicks or HAL in 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Open the pod bay doors, HAL.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, HAL?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, HAL.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
Where the hell did you get that idea, HAL?
Dave, although you took very thorough precautions in the pod against my hearing you, I could see your lips move.
All right, HAL.
All right, HAL. HAL sounds a bit like your mum when she's really not happy, doesn't he? Just calm, just quiet, and awfully menacing. But it seems that some big names in tech are also sounding the alarm about the potential of artificial intelligence. Elon Musk, the inventor of PayPal and the Tesla car, says AI is our biggest existential threat and we should be very careful about it. So how might artificial intelligence change the way you live? Will you be sipping cocktails by the pool while robots do everything for you? Or will artificial intelligence wipe out the middle class and widen the income gap? The biggest tech companies in the world are furiously working on developing AI, but is it something we really want? Toby Walsh is from NICTA, NICTA, Australia's Information Communications Technology Research Centre of Excellence, and he's from the University of New South Wales. His research focuses on artificial intelligence, and I asked him for a layman's definition of what it is.
Yes, it's trying to make computers more intelligent, get them to do tasks that we would normally think of ourselves as intelligent.
Are they there already to a certain extent?
So if we pick a very narrow domain at which we get computers to work in, then there are computers out there that are achieving human level, in fact, even superhuman level of performance. But if you actually think of the big package, everything that we do in our everyday lives now, we're still some way off. My colleagues like to say it's, 30 or 40 years away before we really have computers that can behave intelligently and all the sorts of tasks that we do. And they've been saying that for about 30 or 40 years. But there is now, I think, a scent that we're actually, it's going to happen in our lifetimes.
Why is it so difficult to build a computer or a machine or a robot, whatever it might be, with artificial intelligence?
Well, we're trying to replicate what the human brain does, and the human brain is by far, orders of magnitude, the most complicated system that we know of in the universe. We haven't found anything else that approaches the complexity, all the billions of neurons and all the trillions of connections that are there. And so trying to get that performance out of, and the human brain does that with remarkably little energy. It does it with 20 watts or so of energy. So it's an amazing thing. And we've only been working on artificial intelligence now for 50 or so, 60 years. So it's going to take us a little while, I think, to get to that level of complexity.
How would our lives benefit from artificial intelligence?
The prospects are great. I should say also that, there are people who are concerned about the risks, but certainly the prospects are great, that they can remove all the drudgery from our lives, that they can solve all the healthcare problems that we have. They can help tackle global warming, all the problems that we face. If we could only make better decisions in life and we had computers that could take away some of those decisions from us, the prospects are great. And some of the things, some of the problems that face the world today could be solved that way.
There are many companies and research labs investing a lot of money into artificial intelligence. For a company like Google, for example, how would it benefit from AI?
Well, Google is spending a lot of money. I mean, they've just spent over $500 million buying an AI company called DeepMind, and many of the other technology companies, Yahoo, Baidu, which is the Chinese version of Google. All these technology companies are investing in a big way in artificial intelligence, and they see Google has to organize information. They see artificial intelligence as a way to do that on the scale that Google operates at. You'll get better search results. You'll get your phone will be able to understand you better when you speak to your phone. You'll get more personalized responses that work better for you. So hopefully it will turn into a better user experience. There are people who are worried that Google now claims to employ at least 5% of the world's population of deep learning AI experts now. Some people in academia are worried that these corporations are actually going to have too much power.
Mm.
The share worth of Google is now actually, I think, around about the GDP of Luxembourg. So these corporations are almost like countries. And so, we may have to worry that they have too much influence over our lives.
Well, Google's chief engineer, Ray Kurzweil, recently told MIT Technology Review that he envisaged a cybernetic friend based on deep learning that listens in on your phone conversation, reads your emails, tracks your every move, so it can tell you things you want to know even before you ask. And now, for some people, that will sound great. To others, that will sound like a stalker. It's very much about personal interpretation, too, as to whether or not you're going to see AI as friend or foe.
Yes, I don't think that's just a problem for AI. I think that's a conversation that society is starting to have and needs to have about privacy and about information. And there's been a number of events, WikiLeaks, the Snowden affair and so on, where we're starting to realize that we do have to worry about our privacy and about what we let corporations like Google and Facebook know about us and what the limits should be placed on that. Unfortunately, AI is a technology that can be used for good or bad. If it can help serve us better and we're happy with that, then that's a good thing. But of course, if it's listening in and getting us into various other troubles, then that may be a bad thing.
Toby Walsh, what is the Turing test?
The Turing test is an interesting test that was proposed by Alan Turing, one of the grandfathers of computers, back in the 50s, to try and identify when we had succeeded in building artificial intelligence. It's very hard to know whether we succeeded or not. So he proposed a test that we could actually run. You would actually sit down and talk to a computer and talk to a person, and then you would try and work out which person, which you were talking to. Were you talking to the computer or were you talking to a person? If you couldn't tell the computer apart from the person, then he argued that the computer was behaving intelligently or was seeming to behave intelligently, and then it would have said to have been passed the Turing test and have to reach a level of human intelligence.
ABC Local Radio Queensland, you're with Kelly Higgins-Devine this afternoon. We're talking about artificial intelligence, and Toby Walsh is from NICTA, Australia's Information Communications Technology Research Centre of Excellence, and also he's with the University of New South Wales, and his research focuses on AI. I was reading an article earlier this morning on algorithms that are able to put together articles and reports on particular topics based on the information that's fed into them. They can then give you very cogent newspaper reports, for example, or results of sporting matches, those sorts of things. It seems like journalists might be one of those in the firing line of this technology as it improves.
As you say, the technology will be changing the nature of work and actually putting some people possibly out of their current jobs and creating new jobs elsewhere. And one area where that's certainly going to happen is going to be journalism. There are more lines of articles written by computers today than there are by humans. And they can write very convincing sports reports and financial stock reports and so on.
I wonder how many people listening this afternoon knew at all that what they're reading possibly could have been put together by a computer rather than a human being.
Yes, I mean, I don't think it's flagged in a great way for you to realise, but if you follow the stock market, then quite a few of the financial reports you read about a company releasing some report on its earnings or something is probably written by a computer program. I think this is actually a conversation that society needs to have quite soon, which is how AI and technology as a whole is going to change the nature of work. And it's going to take away many, many jobs and create other jobs. I mean, if you think about it today, there aren't many people who are typesetting press anymore, but there are thousands of people now who are web designers. That job didn't exist when typesetting was first started. So some jobs disappear, some other new jobs change. There's an interesting debate that economists are having about whether more jobs get destroyed than get created, and it's certainly a conversation we need to have to think about, do we have to work less? We play a little nice after-dinner game at my conferences, which is we try and think of a job that's future-proof. So you have to name a job. So you would say journalism, and I say, well, actually, no, there are lots of algorithms already writing journals, writing reports in papers and so on. Mm. And one of us then has to come up with an argument as to why that would be future-proof or not. In fact, it's actually almost impossible to play this game. Almost any job you can think, whether it be doctor, lawyer, accountant. The one job that we came up with that's quite a good winner in this conversation is politician. We reckon the politicians will be the last people who will allow themselves to be taken over by a computer.
Well,
another good one's AI researcher.
Oh, yeah, researcher.
A researcher. Sure. But even there, we computers are being creative, and there are some computer programs now that are designing drugs.
One of the concerns that is raised about this is that once AI really does get going, that the middle class, those people are most at danger of losing their jobs and of jobs not being created. Because if you're saying any job can be taken over by a computer or a machine in the end, then the rich get richer, the poor really do get poorer. You wipe out don't we run the risk of wiping out jobs that the middle class now have?
Yes, I think that's a very great concern, and that's something that certainly I'm starting to worry about the consequences. I think it's not just technology. I mean, we're seeing a concentration of wealth, inequalities that the global financial crisis are actually amplifying, and technology is a pressure that's only going to make this potentially worse. And as you say, the middle class professions are jobs that previously you might have thought were pretty safe from some of these pressures, but now with technology, many of those jobs could also be automated. I certainly try and worry about what I could suggest to my daughter to go to university and study is that would make her future-proof. And it's hard to think of what the right answer is, certainly in terms of the middle-class profession.
Maybe computer programming? But are we getting to the point where computers will be able to program themselves? We don't.
Yes,
we just tell them what we want and bang, there it is.
Well, computer programming, I would encourage your listeners to think about computer programming. There are 100,000 unfilled jobs in IT in Australia today. We struggle at the university, in the University of New South Wales, where I teach at. We struggle sometimes to get our students to finish because we get companies coming in and employing them before they say, don't bother to finish your degree, come and work for us. We get some companies that come and say, can we come and talk to your class about recruiting some students? And we say, well, how many students are you looking to recruit this year? And they say, well, how big's the class? And we say, well, there's about 50 in the class. They say, well, we've hired all of them, if you like.
My nephew learns coding. He goes to a school in Hong Kong, and he's learning it. He loves it. And yet my daughter's in year 7, and sometimes I'll look at the subject she's doing, and, you know, I know history's important, for example, but there's a part of me that says, you know what, I think I'd rather she was learning coding, even though history is important too. Or
yes.
I don't know how we balance the real world need to the classical education need.
Getting coding into the curriculum is certainly something that myself and a lot of colleagues would love to do. And there's one other big thing that you sort of alluded to there as well, which is the gender divide in computer science. It's really worrying to see, you know, the class is 95% full of boys. There are a number of initiatives out there. I've actually come to a realization that you have to start incredibly young on this one. That we put various sticky plaster on the problem at university, and we have Girls Who Can Code and various events and various organizations to try and keep the girls that have still managed to stick around to this point to stay in the game. But the problem is that we didn't get 50% of them in at the start. And so actually I'm a scientist in a school, a girls' school, because I think we have to start at age 5 or 6 because it's just too late. And when there are 100,000 unfilled jobs, you just think that would be just fantastic if we could fill those jobs if we could double the size of the classes by having an equal balance of girls.
You're with Kelly Higgins-Devine on ABC Local Radio Queensland, and Toby Walsh is from NICTA, Australia's Information Communications Technology Research Centre of Excellence, and the University of New South Wales. And today our conversation is about artificial intelligence. Toby, what about, at the start of this segment, I talked about, you know, a little bit of fun with Terminator and a bit of HAL as well from 2001 Space Odyssey, because they're probably the best known pop culture examples of artificial intelligence. And it goes wrong. It goes terribly, terribly wrong. And even though I'm not suggesting that we're going to have Terminators roaming the planet anytime soon, do we run the risk of artificial intelligence in many, many decades to come deciding that, you know what, human beings, just they're just too much work and they're actually not much good for the planet, so we're not going to help you anymore?
There's certainly an existential concern there and something that we do have to think about in the long term. I would suggest there are much more pressing concerns that we really need to have to think about today, like global warming. Mm-hmm. But it's something that we can't completely forget. And there are, you know, there's the Future of Humanity Institute, and there's a number of research programs being started up in the last decade to actually think about these existential threats. One thing that you have to consider is that sometimes the idea of intelligence gets mixed up with the idea of sentience. Mm-hmm. Sentience is the fact that you get a machine to think and feel, and we're a long way from sentience, even if we have got intelligence in computers. The programs that we write don't actually at the moment have a desire, you know, to actually go off and do other things. They only want to do the thing that they are programmed to do. In fact, there's no wanting in them. They only can do the thing. There's no want in them yet. But we will, in the long term, have to think about what we're creating. And like all technologies, there's good and bad that they can be put to. And it's something that, you know, I think it's a deep-founded human fear that we're always creating things and worrying that they will go wrong. I mean, the nuclear weapons were... Nuclear technology has great promise in terms of solving our power problems, but also has, you know, as we've witnessed, has also a great destructive potential as well. And with artificial intelligence, from the very first days, the word robot actually was invented in a Czech play by... a writer called Kapek in the 1920, he wrote the play. And that play was about robots, or androids, as they were called. In fact, at the end of the play, the robots actually kill all the humans. And so you can see from the very first use of the word robot, we've been worrying about this this scenario.
What is your greatest hope for AI?
I think it can help us tackle some of the great pressing problems in terms of poverty and disease that and global warming and so on that the world faces. If you can take a program that runs on your smartphone and take it to every third world village and give them first world health care, that would be a great benefit to society. I mean, people are needlessly dying every day of very simple diseases and things that we have fixes for already, and so it's sad that we haven't got there yet. But you know, technology has a promise there, and artificial intelligence has a part to play in that to really help us alleviate some of the suffering in the world. And so, you know, it would be great if we could do those things.
Toby Walsh from NICTA, Australia's Information Communications Technology Research Centre of Excellence, and the University of New South Wales, talking about artificial intelligence. We asked the question on Facebook, you know, AI seems a long way off, but it has the potential to help us in areas of health, planning and education. How do you think it could best be used? Jessica says, housework. I want a robot made like in the Jetsons. Yes, we all want a Rosie the robot. I agree, Jessica. Also, a large part of my job is customer service. An AI computer could easily answer the majority of dumb questions I'm asked. Then I could get some real work done. Ralph wants to see politics gone, or not gone, but AI used in politics, get some rational, educated decisions made. Phil says maybe artificial intelligence could tell us that the Earth really is finite and that the law of diminishing returns is true. And on the SMS, why are we trying to get machines to have super intelligence when we should be exploring how to make human brains super intelligence?
ABC, local radio, Queensland.
When you get those quizzes that ask you which superpower you would like, being invisible, super strength, for example, being able to fly, being able to read people's minds, which one do you choose? Because I either like invisibility because you can, you know, hear a lot of stuff without people knowing you're there, and I'm a bit like that. I'm a journalist. Or having the ability to read people's minds. Well, most of us have dreamed about having telepathic powers at some point. Did you know that recent studies have actually found direct transmission of a brain activity between two humans? It does sound like something from a sci-fi movie, but could this be the future? A future where phones, we don't need them anymore. We can just communicate with each other telepathically. Dr. Kristen Bates is from the University of Western Australia, where she's an assistant professor in neuroscience. Good afternoon, Dr. Bates.
Hello, Kelly. How are you?
Very well. Now, this study where they reported direct transmission of brain activity between humans, what does that actually mean?
Okay, so what these researchers basically did was to combine two existing technologies together in order to make this whole idea possible. So what they did was to come up with a way of reading the brain waves that our brains are putting out all the time. They found a way of transmitting that specific thoughts in all of those waves to another person via a brain stimulator called transcranial magnetic stimulation. So in order to do that, they set up people playing a video game, basically, and first of all, they were able to show that a remote person from a remote location could control somebody else's body, which was kind of freaky.
Mm-hmm.
And then another group thought, oh, maybe we could try and transmit thought as well. So they came up with a system of translating ideas, so hello and goodbye, into a binary code, so one or zero, and then transmitting that one or zero thought across the world to somebody else. And it worked, which was to everybody's surprise, I suppose.
Interesting. So were they thinking about the word hello or goodbye or the number that was attached to it?
They were thinking about the number that was attached to it. And then that got transmitted over the internet to someone in a remote location. And then using this brain stimulator, the receiver got a stimulation to their visual cortex at the back of the brain. And when the person saw particular lights in the computer screen, they knew that that meant either zero or one.
Mm.
And they knew that that in turn meant hello or goodbye.
That's kind of freaky, isn't it?
Yeah.
To use a very technical scientific term.
Yes.
When you describe brain waves, what are they exactly? And do they reside just within the brain or do they, this sounds very sci-fi as well, but are they coming out outside of our actual heads?
Yeah, so your body is an electrical organ, and in particular your brain. There's a lot of electrical activity that happens in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And even when you're asleep, your brain is churning over things and you can read brain waves. So people who watch medical shows and or people who unfortunately have been in this position in hospital with a loved one, the brain waves can be used to read the person's brain activity. So if there's no activity, then we're known as brain dead, and then various decisions can be made after that. So your brain is always pumping out these waves. And we can read them using a technique called electroencephalography, which is what we shorten to EEG because that's a lot easier to say than electroencephalography. And that's basically where someone wears like a swimming cap, which has a whole pile of wires attached to it, and a computer can read the waves, or you can also use it with little patches with wires, electrodes attached as well.
With that, we can tell there's activity. Can we tell much about the actual thought itself, what somebody might be dreaming about or thinking about? To like, if I start thinking about what I had for lunch, are we able to interpret that at this stage?
Well, that seems to be the really big leap forward that these researchers have been able to make, is deciphering in all of that brainwave activity a particular wave or a particular pattern of activity that was associated with a particular thought. So the person who was the sender of the information Kin and Agent had to be concentrating really, really hard on this, and the researchers had to make a computer program that could sort through all of the other brain activity and pick a pattern that was specific to that particular thought.
Mm. Because I was going to say, there's a lot that happens in your brain simultaneously. It's not as if you actually have just that one thought that then comes through quite clearly. You're taking in so much stimuli around you anyhow that must be being processed by your brain, that finding that particular thought would be difficult.
Yes, that's where they had these clever computer scientists come in and help them with that, because as you say, even as you're sitting there, there is lots of activity that your brain is taking in and processing, and you're probably also thinking about who's going to pick up the kids after school and what you're going to have for dinner and all these kind of things as well.
Mm.
So there's a fancy computer program that they have been able to develop that can sort through all of that information.
So when we get this further developed, how would it work? Would it be like hearing someone's voice in your head, or more like a thought that then you just decipher?
I think it would be more of the deciphering type of technology. So similar to how the receiver of those human-to-human experiments saw the lights and then you... a light in this location of the screen meant zero and in the other location meant one. I think it would be a decoding type process for the receiver to actually have. So I can't see it possible in the very near future that I would be able to know exactly what somebody else is thinking, and I don't think I'd want to know exactly what somebody else is thinking. It's this kind of thing. I mean, it raises so many fascinating questions and ideas, and I think there needs to be a lot of talk in the community about, well, would we really want this to happen for general everyday purposes, or would we really want to restrict this to things like rehabilitation from brain injuries and specific training type programs, which would probably be really helpful. And it may also be helpful in trying to help people who perhaps can't decode body language very well and emotions very well, and it might help in those kind of things as well. But I think for general day-to-day life, I mean, Facebook and social media is enough of people putting their thoughts out there, I reckon.
Well, the other thing too is there's no doubt that the military would have applications for this type of technology.
Yeah.
And that's where we'd have to be very careful.
Yes. So one of the key things that the authors emphasise for these groups is that, look, this kind of thing, it only really works well if both people are engaged in the experiment. Mm. So if the other person, if the receiver of the information is concentrating on something else or is distracted or isn't able to attend to the task particularly well, then the transmission doesn't work. So I don't think we need to wear our alfoil helmets to stop.
Just yet?
No. Signals coming in yet. But, you know, it's this conscious engagement of both brains had to be occurring for this to happen.
Yeah.
So, even what we already know about how cognition and processes of good cognitive performance occurs, I really do think both people would have to be engaged in the task for it to happen.
Could humans one day be able to communicate with animals telepathically, or is there part of language that would make that particularly even more difficult than it is just to communicate with each other telepathically?
Yeah, that's a good question, because there was a paper that I uncovered in researching this story that people had actually done that. So they had hooked up a human and a rat brain, and they were able to control the rat body to make their tail twitch. So we haven't sent signals the other way yet from a rat into a person.
That would be interesting to find out what the rat wanted to make us do.
Yeah, very interesting.
Open the cage.
You know, the dog might just be saying, feed me what we want me. Yep. That's okay. But
the cat would be saying, be my slave.
Yes. My litter box needs cleaning, please.
Yes.
That would open up a wonderful new way of really understanding our place in, I guess, evolution as well, and having better ideas of animal rights and what may be good and bad and Maybe it would make us all turn vegetarian. I don't know.
Well, it's a way off, but interesting. Yeah. The repercussions, you never know, do you?
No, you don't. And I think, I guess that's another thing that this kind of research raises is that, you know, science is, we're able to do all these kind of things and sometimes I guess the consequences of that aren't realised at the time, and it's sometime later down the track that perhaps it's a bit of a Pandora's box of things that get away with it. But that happens frequently in their, you know, technology and stuff. And
yeah.
Who would have thought inventing the wheel would lead to climate change?
So. That's right. Or being able to send a rocket into space.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't think we should necessarily stop trying to do these kind of fantastic things because we're worried about where I don't think we should be limited by those kind of things, but just be really responsible and engage really well in the public and what it is that we want out of technology and science.
Dr. Kristen Bates, thank you so much for sharing your expertise.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Kristen Bates from the University of Western Australia, where she's an assistant professor in neuroscience. Well, Ted on Twitter says, after the rat and human were hooked up, the human went to law school. You just mean, Ted.
ABC Local Radio Queensland.
Well, remember during the early 2000s when the mobile phone trend was to have them as small as possible? And these days it seems the trend is going the other way and our phones are getting bigger and bigger. But that might not be the case for much longer. Technologies are being developed that could see our phones become part of our clothing. That's not the only wearable technology in the works. There are plenty of other concepts being developed, including clothes that might be able to harvest and utilise the energy that you emit. Dr. Adam Best joins me. He's a senior research scientist at CSIRO who's been working on the idea of flexible batteries.
Yes, we started working on flexible batteries back in 2007 as a program we started with the Australian Defence Department, where we wanted to reimagine how soldiers would carry electronic equipment on their ensemble. And part of the idea was, how could we lighten the load of soldiers' burden when they're out in the field, provide them with more energy and more capability?
You know what? I think I might have talked with you about this at the time because
yes,
I thought it was an outstanding idea. How did it go? Did it work?
Yes, it worked fabulously. We were very, very happy and pleased with the outcome. We basically started from zero, and by the end, we actually were able to demonstrate to the Army a capability that they didn't have previously. And since then, we've been continuing to work on the technology and further improve it.
How's it going? Anywhere near sort of commercial application yet?
So the technology that we developed is in three parts. We actually called it the flexible integrated energy device, and it comprises of the flexible battery as one component, electronic textiles as a secondary component, and the third part is an energy harvesting technology. And that's where you're using human movement to actually create energy and then use that to power electronic devices or charge a battery. So different technologies are at different readinesses, so the energy harvesting technology, we're very keen to actually find commercial partners to actually take that into the marketplace and integrate that into backpacks, laptops, bags, anything of that type. Our electronic textiles, we're also fairly long way down the track with that, so we're actually now looking to actually make fabrics that we can then integrate directly into garments. But the flexible battery is a very, as your listeners would know, batteries are pretty expensive. They're also a fairly dangerous item, so we need to do a lot of qualification to ensure that the battery is safe for use for consumers.
Mm. Dr. Best, my expert on trends has been talking about fibre technology for a long time, and just it was in early days when we first started talking with you about how it was going to be developed, how we might use it, and he had a bit of a look at your project and has said to me it is one of the best he's ever seen in this area, just the economy of it, the sort of fibres you're using as well, and how this might be applied. So let's talk about the fibres, whereas other projects tend to use quite expensive fibres. You're going with cotton and wool to generate power.
Yes, we use the cotton and fibre and wool because these are the base fabrics which have are well known in the market. Lots of it is available. They're intrinsically flexible. They have very large surface areas that we can use to absorb energy storage materials. So the cotton and the wool in and of itself is not conductive. We actually have to treat it with advanced materials to actually make it that way. And so by using flexible, robust nature of the fabrics, we can actually turn them into electrode materials that can be then put into a flexible battery.
Would that alter the feel of the garment?
Yes, so you won't actually feel the battery per se on your person. We actually have to also look at sealing the battery up because we still need other common things that you would find in a battery, like an electrolyte, which is a liquid-like material which commutes the ions between the negative and the positive electrode. So we need to seal the battery up so that moisture and oxygen don't get into the battery to degrade its performance. So you'll see a polymer-like surface across that, but it should not change the actual wear and feel of the actual battery.
How do you envisage it working? What would I be able to do with, say, a shirt made of this material?
Well, you could think of things like running instead of, taking a step back, we see this as wearable 2.0, to borrow a bit of the internet language. So at the moment, your listeners are familiar with Jawbones and Fitbits, which are very much like a watch. You put them on in the day. They're not per se part of your garment. You don't just go and grab it out of your closet. You put it on in the morning or you wear it in the shower. So we actually see these textiles and fabrics and the battery actually being seamlessly integrated into your garment, such that you might have in there, if you're an elderly person, you might have a heart issue, so you might be able to wear that with a heart monitor there, so that if you have a heart arrhythmia, that you might be able to inform your doctor electronically that you're having an issue, and particularly if you're living in a nursing home, and that could then trigger an alarm. You could also think of wearing a garment if you're out in doing adventure sports, which has a GPS in there. You get lost, it could actually send a signal such that you could be found again. So there's plenty of technology here. Ultimately, you may want to think about pulling your mobile phone apart, such that in your collar of your mobile phone, you have you'd have the actual transceiver there, you'd have the battery in the garment, and therefore you would not actually have to carry around the big block that you do nowadays.
How much motion and thermal energy do humans produce? Is it enough to power a phone?
Actually, amazingly, the human body can produce a huge amount of energy. The biggest problem is the materials that we use to try and actually capture that energy. And at the moment, the efficiency of those materials is quite poor. So at the moment, in terms of thermal energy, no, we can definitely not capture enough of that to run a mobile phone. But if we think of motion energy harvesting, we can absolutely do that.
So what sort of things are we using to capture energy at the moment?
Actually, on your person, we don't do that at all at the moment. So this is definitely a technology that's coming, and there are a lot of companies who are exploring this space as well about how they can capture energy from human movement.
I know you were working with the Army for flexible batteries. Is this something that that would have, the military is interested as well, being able to have these fibres to keep things charged?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. We've had great interest from different armies in this technology space, and we'll be presenting some of this technology at a conference in the UK later this year, and we have presented parts of it at other meetings as well. So we're hoping to actually in the next 12 months actually seek some commercial deals so that we can actually transition some of this exciting technology from the laboratory actually out into the marketplace. Mm-hmm.
I remember Andre Laporte, my trend spotter, talking in 2012 about a Kenyan who was given a grant or some sort of award for power generating sneakers. There were crystals in the heel of the sneaker that generated power. Is that where we might get an easier source of power in our feet? Because we're constantly, there's constant pressure, energy going into our feet.
Sure, yeah, and that's a very common method. But one of the problems that your listeners may also be aware of is that to actually get the energy from your foot to somewhere in your garment on your torso, you need to have some wires there, and not everyone wants to be electrically connected to their shoes in that regard. So
that's fair.
Yeah. So and to be honest, the American military has played around with this for many, many years, and they've actually abandoned the idea again, just simply out of ergonomic purposes. But I do remember that young man man's efforts to actually, he had a little USB port in the bottom of his shoe that he could plug his phone into. And really, for people in energy-constrained societies, it's a fantastic thing. Actually, I'm not sure how many of your listeners want to be standing on the side of the road with their phone plugged into their shoe.
Not me. Seeing as they're so big now, I mean, so it's all right when it used to be the tiny little, you know, flip phones that
Absolutely.
We had, but now they're what, the phablets?
The phablets. Yeah, you'd be running a long way. You'd need to be Steve Monteghetti to get enough energy there.
That ain't going to happen anytime soon. Mm. Dr. Bess, the wearable technologies. They do sound fantastic, but how far are they really from being put on the market?
So really, at the moment, we're very keen to sign a company or anyone to actually take the technology on. We've got designs and patents and all the rest. So we're very confident that we could easily apply some of our technology today with the right partner. The flexible battery, as I said earlier, it's a bunch different question. There are a lot of safety questions we have to answer in order to ensure that we can develop a robust, safe technology that consumers can purchase and use. So that we would see at least being another 3 years away. But we, again, are looking for partners to invest with us to actually help us accelerate this technology to bring it to the market.
What are you most excited about when it comes to this technology?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Actually, I have a great team of people who are extremely excited about the work that we do together. And that's part of the fun, actually, working with some really fantastic engineers and scientists to bring a concept from, you know, a sketch on the back of a beer coaster into reality. And that's where a lot of these ideas come from. So that to me is one of the part of the fun. And I suppose we all have a nice dream of one day walking into a store and plucking our technology off the rack and asking us, would you like us to tell you what that's about? And saying, no, we're pretty happy. We know what we're buying here.
I can tell you more about it than you can tell me.
Probably that's not good to boast.
But oh, heck no. I reckon you own that.
Yeah. So, absolutely. That's something that we're very excited about. And I think the other thing is we think we can improve people's lives with this technology, and particularly as we have an aging population, and anything where we can give people more independence and allow them to age comfortably in their homes and without having to worry about their health and well-being, we believe that this can help them do that type of thing. So if we can bring these to market, we think we can have a very, very strong impact.
Great talking with you, Dr. Adam Best. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly.
Adam Best, a senior research scientist at CSIRO, and Top Level Ted says, in terms of wearable tech, Apple Watches are all fine, but we still don't have a shoe phone, which seems a little careless.
The ABC in your community.
ABC Local Radio, Queensland.